difficult music, harsh electronics, spoken word, cut up / collage, and a general Chris Benn weirdness. Sunday, 7 to 9 a.m. at CITR 101.9 FM.
Catalano Street Party, Vancouver's biggest music and arts festival, is back July 12th from 11 a.m. until 9 p.m. Come on down to West 4th Avenue for over 50 great bands, including Grapes of Wrath, Ben Sinister, Humans, Lightning Dust, and a special performance by the Poppy Family, starring Susan Jax with members of the New Pornographers, Black Mountain, and Destroyer. Over 40 tasty food carts, hundreds of Vancouver's best vendors, and the new Desjardins Family Zone will highlight the day. Catalano Street Party, Saturday, July 12th, brought to you with love by the merchants of West 4th Avenue. Timber Concerts and CITR present The Fresh and Onlys, with special guest The Shilohs, Friday, July 11th at the Electric Owl Social Club. It's an early show, with doors at 7 and the show at 8. Tickets are available at Red Cat Records and Zulu Records or online at ticketweb.ca. For more information, go to thefreshandonlys.blogspot.ca. Whoever said money can't buy you friends obviously wasn't a member at CITR. When you become a member, you get the Friends of CITR card with incredible discounts on Commercial Drive and other areas at
Bone Rattle Music Limited, High Life Records, People's Co-op Bookstore, Audio Pile Records, Bad Bird Media, Band Merch Canada, Vancouver Music Gallery, and Pandora's Box Rehearsal Studios.
To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the Sub on the UBC campus or go online to citr.ca. The 37th Annual Vancouver Folk Music Festival comes to Jericho Beach Park July 18th to the 20th. Over 60 acts from Joan Baez, Andrew Bird, Amos Lee, and Mary Lambert to Ozo Motley and Mauritania's Noura Mintsemali. There's a world of amazing music coming to your own backyard. The Vancouver Folk Music Festival. Info and tickets at thefestival.bc.ca. To understand more about fashion, we asked CITR student executive and fashion expert Jonathan Q what fashion means to him.
It's just aesthetically something that's so ostentatious. Typically. It's also, when you say fashion, I think people are talking explicitly about consumerism as opposed to someone who buys, let's say someone buys it.
If you really want to know more about fashion, come on down to CITR in the Student Union Building of UBC and pick up some of our merchandise à la mode. Nous avons t-shirts, sweatshirts, socks, and coffee mugs.
But it's also very aesthetically gripping.
To keep you styling in support of the station you love. Isn't that right, Jonathan?
Well, actually, is it? Because, I was going to say because of the cultural vacuum that we exist within, but then, really, fashion today is kind of derived from the European idea of couture, and that's been around for centuries.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. It is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative.
Today is Friday, July 11th, And I'm Marco.
And I'm Alex Sarah Davis. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5:07 and time for a full hour of independent campus, local and international news. Today's top stories and segments are, segment one, our science and technology correspondent Marco, who's me, I will discuss this week's top science and technology stories.
We also have a piece from Northern News correspondent Morgan Yee, who spoke with Dr. Peter Newbery about proposed funding from TransCanada for a new sports complex in the rural community of Hazelton, BC. But first, some headlines for today. In campus news, the Special Olympics Canada 2014 Summer Games are here. This past week, UBC has been hosting the largest ever Canadian Special Olympics, with over 2,000 athletes, coaches, and officials in attendance. The games, running from July 8th to July 12th, invited athletes with intellectual disabilities from across Canada and featured 11 events, including basketball, powerlifting, rhythmic gymnastics, swimming, and several other sports. UBC's Vice President of Students, Louise Cowan, said that, quote, "Hosting the Special Olympics on campus has been an opportunity to introduce our community to people with intellectual disabilities," adding that for members of the community that have interacted with the events, quote, "whether by volunteering, coming out to watch the opening ceremony or the sports competition, or even reading about the games, I hope that they will become further educated about people with intellectual disabilities." Cowan said that the games should be an opportunity for us to pause, reflect, and celebrate the accomplishments of these athletes. The games will wrap up tomorrow, and more information, including the schedule of events, can be found online at www.vancouver2014.com. Once again, that's www.vancouver2014.com.
In local news, Vancouver continues its winning streak as the most expensive living city in Canada. Vancouver topped the list of most expensive Canadian cities to live in once again this year, surpassing Toronto as well as Montreal and Calgary in Mercer's 2014 Cost of Living Survey. However, Canadian cities overall have dropped in the global rankings, analysts say, due to the weakened Canadian dollar and slower inflation in local prices, especially when compared with New York, the survey's base city. Vancouver fell 32 places for a new ranking at 96th, with Toronto at 101st, and Montreal and Calgary 20 places lower still. The most expensive cities to live in remain Luanda in Angola, one of my favorite cities, followed by Djamena in Chad. In third and fourth place, Hong Kong and Singapore aren't very cheap either. The updated rankings won't affect anything in our daily lives, but they are a reassuring sign that despite the cost of living in Vancouver, it could always be worse.
And in national news, controversy surrounding the government's proposed prostitution law continues. Last year, the Supreme Court of Canada struck down the prostitution laws that had been submitted by Parliament, citing their breach of sex workers' rights to security and freedom of expression. The court gave Parliament 1 year to produce legislation that respect the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. The result is Bill C-36, which has been at the center of recent controversy. This week, the House Justice Committee heard from 60 witnesses over more than 20 hours of meetings, fielding a range of criticism and some praise on the new laws. The praise came from organizations like the Women's Coalition for the Abolition of Prostitution, or WCAP, who were pleased to see the Canadian government criminalizing the purchasers who create the demand for paid sex. Like the WCAP, have long argued that it is the customers, not the sex workers, who should be criminalized. On the other hand, the committee heard from many critics who say that, among other problems, the bill doesn't clearly define the sexual services it is trying to outlaw. Tim Lambrinos, a representative from the Adult Entertainment Association of Canada, told MPs on Wednesday that there is no explicit line drawn between massage parlors, strip clubs, and prostitution. What counts as sexual service? In response, Conservative MP Joy Smith said that there is no need to define sexual services. Quote, "Everybody pretty well knows what it's about. What needs to happen is talking about stopping the predatory nature of prostitution and human trafficking, stopping the brutalization of the women and children and young boys involved, and that is the focus of the bill." Lambrinos said that the intentions behind C-36 may be good, but, quote, "you don't even define what sexual activity is, and there are no tools in place for the police to implement." A spokeswoman for the Department of Justice said, "it's ultimately up to the courts to decide what will be covered by the new law." The House Justice Committee will meet again this coming week to go over the bill clause by clause.
And in international news?
There's no international news. Not this week. Those have been your campus, local, and national headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Up next, we have our weekly science and technology segment with Marco. Hey, Marco.
Good. Welcome, listeners. There is a bit of international news, and it'll be in our science and technology section. Well, everybody knows it's that time of year, or that time when everybody is mad about World Cup soccer. So I'm here wearing my elephant shirt with an elephant kicking the ball. And the reason I'm doing that is because we have a new star in Europe. Yes, Nelly the elephant is becoming a star. Nelly took the place of the octopus that died a few years ago after celebrating his 13 out of 14 World Cup predictions. Paul the octopus died shortly after that. Now Nelly is being chosen to kick balls into the net to predict the outcome of World Cup matches, but she has been wrong most of the time, so I'm not sure what happened with Nelly now. But Paul, or Big Head, the turtle in Brazil, has been retired because he incorrectly forecast so many of the matches. Now, in more serious news, and this is very serious news, we're going to go straight and talk about Justin Bieber, or as he is now known, Bizzle. So we know that Justin Bieber and Rob Ford brought a little bit of shame on our country, but now Justin Bieber's looking good. That is because of his bangs that sweep across his forehead. Yes, doctors are now citing Justin Bieber's bangs as being more than just fashionable. Doctors at Johns Hopkins University in America are talking about the problems with protection from the sun. And Justin Bieber's bangs, they say, are one example of how young people can protect themselves from ultraviolet rays from the sun. So when pickles are thought to be markers of sun damage and they are linked with melanoma in adults. This is all from Dr. Bernard Cohen from the Johns Hopkins University. So Justin Bieber is starting to look better and make Canada look better. Now in space news, we're going to talk about one of the professors at UBC, Professor Jamie Matthews. In the UBC website, Matthews is involved in a study where they are studying baby stars. Data from two space telescopes. One is a Canadian space telescope called MOST, M-O-S, CORROT, and a French telescope, COROT, are unveiling the internal structure of stars before they've emerged as full-fledged stars. So these are called baby stars. Ultrasounds of the stellar embryos, which have been performed by Jamie Matthews and the research team, are studying the vibration of the sound in stars as the sound waves bounce around inside the stars and then leave the interior of the stars. Professor Matthews is detecting the sound vibrations by subtle changes in the star's brightness. So this then is translated into frequencies to produce models of stellar interiors. Research is comes out this week in Science magazine, and the science is now called echography, which is studying the embryos of baby stars. In other space news, last July 4th and July 3rd, Earth was its farthest distance from the sun. Earth's orbit is very nearly circular. It is a bit elliptical, but not much. The eccentricity of the orbit is very low, which means it is more like a circle. At its closest point, Earth is 3 million miles closer today, or in this time of year, than it is in the winter. Usually the Earth is about anywhere from 93 to 96 million miles away from the sun. This is known as an astronomical unit, 1 AU. So Earth is now at its aphelion. Aphelion comes from the Greek words apo, a way off, and helios, which is sun. Perihelion occurs in the winter, and this just proves that the seasons that are on Earth are created by Earth's tilt, but not its closeness to the sun. In other space news, students in the States are now competing to send a time capsule to Mars. This project is called TC2M, which is short for Time Capsule to Mars. Sounds good, doesn't it? Okay, so the nonprofit organization Explore Mars is having a competition where they plan to land three small satellites called CubeSats on Mars within the next 5 years. I don't know why the UBC engineers are not getting involved in this, because they could probably do it themselves. In other news, there is a mysterious X-ray signal coming from space. This X-ray signal has been picked up by the Chandra X-ray Observatory, a telescope in space. The telescope does detailed studies of galaxy clusters in the universe. The X-rays that are coming from this source are, scientists believe, are produced by the decay of sterile neutrinos, and they are a candidate for dark matter. Up till now, dark matter has not been observed, but these X-rays have scientists excited because they think it's the signature of dark matter. Dark matter is thought to make up 85% of the universe, and up till now, it has not been detected because it does not emit or absorb light. The data from the Chandra X-ray telescope has identified X-ray emission lines that are spiked in a very specific X-ray region. So this could be a big payoff. So the sterile neutrinos are hypothetical particles that interact with normal matter only via gravity. Another candidate for the dark matter is the Higgs boson, which are thought to give particles their mass. This is Marco. You have been listening to Science and Technology News on CITR.
Thank you, Marco. Up next, we have a piece from Northern News correspondent Morgan Yee, who spoke with internationally recognized expert on rural family medicine, Dr. Peter Newbery, about proposed funding from TransCanada for a new sports complex in the rural community of Hazelton, BC. Hazelton is a small community north and east of Prince Rupert, situated at the northernmost point of Highway 16. It is comprised of three small communities and seven native reserves spread out across a wide catchment area. The population is approximately 6,500 people. When the softwood lumber industry was booming, Hazleton was a thriving community. However, now Hazleton relies heavily on other natural resources to employ its residents: fishing, hunting, and outdoor recreation. There is much concern over how future energy products, such as pipelines, will impact these activities. The Hazleton region is at the center of a land use struggle, with many locals frustrated by the incursion of drilling contractors on private and crown land throughout the area. Dr. Newbery is the chair of the Hazleton's Strategic Planning Committee, which seeks to secure funding from a variety of sources to fund the proposed $10 million Upper Skeena Recreation Center. One of these sources is TransCanada, a company which builds pipelines. TransCanada has donated $1 million towards the completion of this project. Morgan spoke to Dr. Newbery at Rynch Memorial Hospital today about the project, his thoughts on the juxtaposition of accepting funding from such a contentious source, and the importance of building up community resources.
Dr. Newbery, welcome to News 101.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So what exactly is your role within the heart of the Hazleton?
I was asked by the original Builders Committee and mm-hmm. the Arena Committee to head up what is. We've got big healthcare problems here, as you know, mental health challenges. We've had a lot of issues with our young people around suicide and suicide attempts. Especially 4 or 5 years ago, we got some significant publicity right across the country because we had quite a number of suicide and suicide attempts. We have major issues of hypertension, type 2 diabetes, and health issues with elders and others. Lack of fitness, increasing overweight problems, and so on. So, and the other aspect of it is that only about 40% of our high school students actually graduate from high school. Those who start high school, 40% graduate. So, because of where this recreation center is located, we have an opportunity not only to address some of our recreation issues, but we're planning to, and we've had conversations with the school board about this already, link activity type programs to education to encourage kids to stay in school longer. We've had conversations with Northern Health about the development of healthcare programs for elders in order to try to address some of our hypertension, mm-hmm. diabetes, overweight, lack of fitness, cardiac problems in the community. The general vision is that this recreation center, the movement of which is known as the Heart of the Hazletons, will actually start addressing some of our relatively serious social problems in the community. So my job is to address the financial requirements for getting this arena in place. And it's a fairly steep hill to climb. We're looking at trying to raise about $12 million.
And as I understand, it's $10 million for the building of the arena, and then it's an additional $2 million for the upkeep.
There are a number of aspects to the $12 million, and it actually, with increasing building costs, particularly in the Northwest now, with all of the other things that are going on, that number may have to rise. But what we're aiming at is a two-phase program whereby we replace the old arena, which is presently condemned. So the old arena will be replaced, and then the new arena will probably cost around $10 million. The repurposing of the old arena, we have no idea what that's going to cost, but it's likely going to be in the range of $2 million or so. Mm-hmm. And then what we want to do, because we've got a relatively small population base here, to support that kind of a year-round recreation facility, we're looking at raising another $1 million, which would help to offset the costs of operation for hopefully a period of about 10 years.
With those partnerships, if the school board, you know, and Northern Health were interested in participating in this, would they be also offsetting some of the costs then?
That we have to get into some discussions with. Northern Health already has a program which provides grants to communities with particularly health promotion, disease prevention kinds of programs. We would be looking at applying for some of those. The school board, we still need to talk to about what the practical side of this would look like. But we're looking for an opportunity for some of our operational costs to be offset by those kinds of alliances.
And do you have any idea how much it would cost typically for users to be participating?
And what we've been told by our consultant, his assessment was that it would probably cost us about $260,000 a year to operate this facility. And we could recover some of the costs through the grants that are already in place to operate the arena, the old arena, coming from the regional district and the municipalities, and contributions from other sites, and then from the user fees that would apply. So we're in the process of putting all of that together, but we've already taken a look at, a general look at the cost of operation, and it looks like it's going to be somewhere around $260,000 a year, which is steep for our community.
Now, TransCanada Pipelines, have they donated $1 million, or is it the promise of $1 million?
No, they've committed $1 million.
Okay.
TransCanada Pipeline has committed $1 million to the project with a provision. And the provision is, as you know, that nobody's been actually awarded a license to build the pipeline at this point. So the $1 million that they've committed is contingent on their getting the license to build the pipeline. But to their credit, they have stepped up and provided us with almost $200,000 without any commitment as far as the pipeline is concerned.
Okay. Now, do you have any concerns with accepting funds from a company that is fairly contentious in this area?
It is. And the owners committee thought long and hard about it. I should say that when I took on this job, I went to all of the groups that are represented in our community and have anything to do with the arena, and asked point blank whether they had any problems with accepting money from industry. Nobody had any problems with that. So I know that there are significant issues. I know certainly in our community there is a great deal of resistance with regard to any pipeline. I should say that the pipeline contribution that was made by TransCanada was made to the Gitxad Chiefs and went from the Gitxad Chiefs to the regional district. In our fundraising campaign, the regional district of Kitimat-Stikine holds the funds because they've got the capacity and the expertise and are seen as a trusted agent, if you like, in the process. But TransCanada made the contribution to Gitxad Chiefs, recognizing that the pipeline was coming through Gitxad territory. And I think, personally, I think that was absolutely the right thing to do. I think that in terms of pipeline decisions, I know that there are lots of non-First Nation people living in our community now. But in my view, this is essentially a First Nation decision to make. As newcomers to the country, we have benefited from a situation which has, in effect, taken away the operation of and the decision-making with regard to Gitxad land, and I think it needs to sit back in their hands. I should also say that I met with the hereditary chiefs in their office at the time when we were discussing this and the arena, and the chiefs around the table at that time were all completely in favor of the arena project. Everybody recognizes that it is an essential component of the infrastructure of our community.
You've said that If it's contingent on the pipeline actually being approved, have you seen recently any push from community members to push for the pipeline because of the potential?
No, I certainly haven't. I don't think that anyone is trying to interfere in what is the legitimate process. Nobody on the nobody involved with the ARENA project is pushing to say, please allow this pipeline to go ahead because they've allowed us $1 million.
Looking at this project, it's a lot of money for a small community.
It is.
So I guess the question is, A, is this sustainable? Like, can the community actually, you know, keep this going once it's built? And is this even a realistic project to be considering?
Yeah. We've looked at that really carefully. I think that it is sustainable. We certainly have to look at issues of community access, as you're well aware. We're not just talking about the sort of 3,500 to 4,000 people in the Hazeltons. This community has 8 First Nation villages scattered around about it. We're expecting that those folks will be provided access to the recreation center. We're not quite sure how that's going to happen yet. That's part of a broader community consultation that we're going to take part in. But I think that it is sustainable. As to whether it's an appropriate project for the community broadly has had this kind of discussion. It's a big reach for our community. At the same time, it has the potential to be a symbol of hope and of opportunity for the community in a way that we haven't seen in our community for a long time. I think it's important for your listeners to know that this is the most economically depressed area of the province. In fact, one of the most significantly economically depressed areas of the country. But I think the recreation center can serve as an example of hope and opportunity for other developments in the community, more broadly speaking. For all of the cost, I think the community deserves it. It's worth it, and I'm prepared to put all of my energy, such as it is, into trying to make sure that this community gets what it deserves, since over the last 10 to 15 years, there's been very little attention paid to the community by either provincial or federal government. So this is, I think, in essence, an example of a community, of our community, standing up for itself, just as it did when it built the first arena 40 years ago. People are coming together to say, look, this is something we need in our community. And yes, it's costly. We want it to be something we're proud of, and we think we're worth it.
Thank you very much.
You bet. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Morgan, for that segment. Now we will pause for a PSA break.
In fact, powered by the Canadian Undergraduate Technology Conference is a conference that brings together visionaries, leaders, and enthusiasts from all industries. The conference lets you personalize your own experience from a broad range of breakout sessions and unique workshops. The conference will be held on May 4th at UBC. For more information, go to infect.cutc.ca/Vancouver.
August issue of Discorder is here. Be sure to pick up a copy around town or check it out online at discorder.ca and catch features on Pat Locke, Dirty Spells, Horses Records, The Beelines, and so much more. Also be sure to peep the Discorder playlist, now available through SoundCloud. And a very special thank you to this issue's advertisers, Audiopile Records, CCEC Credit Union, Catalano Street Party, LiveVan.com, the Ponderosa Festival, the Queer Arts Festival, the Rickshaw Theater, Rifflandia, the Media Club, Vancouver Fetish Weekend, Vancouver Fringe Festival, Vancouver Queer Film Festival, the Victory Square Block Party, and Vinyl Records.
It could be global, trance, spoken word, rock, the usual and the weird, or it could be something different. Oral Tentacles, Thursdays 12 to 6 a.m. at CITR 101.9 FM.
And welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. We now have your local weather forecast for the weekend, brought to you by Environment Canada and Christine, who's producing the show today. Hi, Christine.
Hi. So right now, it is currently sunny with a temperature of 23 degrees Celsius. Tonight, the conditions will be clear with a low of 18. Tomorrow, conditions will be sunny, becoming a mix of sun and cloud in the afternoon with a high of 27, except a high of 30 inland. The UV index is very high for tomorrow. Saturday night, the conditions are clear with a low of 17. And finally, for Sunday, conditions are
entitled Food Sovereignty. This series is produced by Frida Worden, and this episode was produced and hosted by Kelia Ramirez-Watson.
Today on Wings, Women and Food Sovereignty with Beverly Bell.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Beverly Bell is the organizational coordinator of Other Worlds, a women-driven education and movement-building collaborative of paid and volunteer organizers, activists, writers, artists, intellectuals, and students that work in Indigenous and Campesino coalitions, research institutions, and grassroots networks. The mission of Other Worlds is to document and educate about alternative models of social and economic relations. Beverly Bell is also the author of Birthing Justice, Women Creating Economic Alternatives, and co-author with Tori Field of Harvesting Justice, Transforming Food, Land, and Agricultural Systems in the Americas. I'm Kelia Ramirez-Watson. On March 5th, 2014, I sat down with Beverly Bell at the office of Food First in Oakland, California, for a discussion of harvesting justice and the issue of food sovereignty. We began with Bell describing the books Birthing Justice and Harvesting Justice and the relationship between them.
Birthing Justice is a book of interviews of 12 remarkable women around the world, each of whom is part of an extraordinary global movement for social, economic, and or gender justice. So the women tell in their own words what they are doing as women within the movement, the role of gender within the movement, and in society at large, and then how their movement is actually creating transformation. Part of it is preserving ancient traditions whereby people are more important than profit and community is more important than commodity. There is absolutely an overlap with harvesting justice. Harvesting justice looks at more than 100 case studies of the transformation of food, land, and agricultural systems in the Americas. And some of the women from Birthing Justice are also part of that story and that movement.
What is food sovereignty?
Food sovereignty says that everyone should have enough to eat. But actually, if you live in the global south and you are the victim of corporate dumping of U.S. taxpayer-paid agribusiness commodities, you might have enough to eat, but you certainly wouldn't have food sovereignty. In fact, agriculture in your country might have been ravaged, would likely have been ravaged by this dumping. So food sovereignty, on the other hand, requires that everyone has enough to eat, but it's also concerned with every aspect of how that food is produced and distributed. It's about the livelihoods and the quality of life of food producers and farmers, fishers, ranchers, farm workers, really everybody in the food supply chain. It also looks at how farming affects the earth. So, for example, the way that people treat the land and the oceans. It has to take into account how international trade policies affect farmers around the world, because that's a huge element. So really, I think that we could say that at its root, food sovereignty is about people having the power to define and create the food systems of which they are a part. Not corporations, not elite governments. It's really about democratizing our food system.
We're getting corporate food all over the world. We're getting health problems because of it. And some movements I know are into, well, what did our ancestors eat? Food sovereignty would help them with that if they want it.
Absolutely. So food sovereignty says that everyone has the right to produce locally food for local consumption. Locally might mean your tomato garden, the produce of which you are then going to take down to the farmer's market. But really, this problem is such that it can't only be about backyard gardeners or CSA farmers.
CSA means community supported agriculture.
Food sovereignty looks at the global trade systems because that's what is screwing agriculture and, in fact, ramping up hunger around the world through land grabs, through undermining local domestic production, through the massive exportation of GMO crops and other toxic chemicals that are used on seeds that destroy local seed stocks. All of those elements are pieces of it. And so food sovereignty blends what might be called food justice, which is looking at the race and class and sometimes gender element of local food systems. It takes into account traditional and indigenous food systems. It looks at people's ability to grow as locally as they can, but then it also incorporates by necessity the global structures. So, for example, the World Bank and the World Trade Organization have played a horrible role in terms of undermining agriculture around the world. So food sovereignty activists also have to look at the international trade and financial institutions as well. When I say food sovereignty activists, of course, it doesn't mean that every person has to do that. You might be a farmer, Kelly, and you would be contributing to food sovereignty, but there have to be people looking at all of the elements to make up the movement.
So how have corporations interfered with food sovereignty?
Corporations, often, again, subsidized by us, by U.S. taxpayers, have been responsible for destroying local production and domestic production around the world, especially in global South countries. I'll just give you the example of Haiti, which is a country where I have worked for 35 years. After the earthquake in Haiti, among the many disgusting disaster profiteers who jumped up and down and salivated and went zinging into Washington to get contracts from what was supposed to be aid for the Haitian people, but many of which largely instead went to corporate contracts. Among them were a lot of agribusiness corporations, notably those who had been given contracts in Arkansas by our fine ex-president, Bill Clinton. And so they immediately got contracts to begin dumping food in Haiti. Well, you can say in the case of a catastrophe, it's very good to have disaster aid, and people were certainly hungry, and yet it's been done in such a way that did not protect local production. Many peasant farmers in Haiti said to me, "We can still grow food." The rural areas, in fact, were not hit by the earthquake of 2010, but what has happened instead is that this agribusiness has come in. It can sell at cheaper prices than Haitian farmers because it grows at economy of scale, and also, again, it's subsidized by taxpayers, which peasant production in Haiti is not. And so especially rice farmers can no longer afford to grow and have gone out of business in droves. And just on this point of Haiti, the earthquake in Haiti was extraordinary in terms of its death toll. In a country of 9 million people, up to 300,000, we don't know the exact number, but up to 300,000 were killed. And it was a 7.0 earthquake on the Richter scale. A few weeks later, in Chile, there was a 7.4 scale earthquake, and only 600 and something people died. Now, why is this? In fact, you can draw a direct line from International Monetary Fund food policies and that death toll. Now you might say, wait, what? But what happened was that the IMF pushed two standby agreements on the Haitian government in the 80s and 90s, and one of the conditions of those agreements was that the Haitian government had to drop their tariffs. That is, they had to drop protection on domestic imports. And so exporters from the U.S. and elsewhere were suddenly able to only pay a very, very tiny percentage of taxes to the Haitian government for exporting their food. Well, immediately, I mean literally almost overnight, Haitian farmers found themselves competing with huge amounts, again, especially of rice, being dumped into the country, and so they went out of business in droves. Hundreds of thousands of those peasant farmers fled their failed farms, either for other countries or for the capital, where they, you know, began working as sweatshop workers or vendors on the street or whatever. But because they were so poor, they could not afford adequate housing. So they had to live, many of them, in very shoddy housing, built in very shoddy and insecure locales. And that was the largest cause of the death, was those substandard houses collapsing on people at the time of the earthquake.
People in Haiti had to eat cookies that are made of a certain type of soil, and the pregnant women especially get certain nutrients from them. But it's basically literally mud pies. Have you heard of that?
Oh, yes, I've heard of them and seen them. They're mud pies, and this is what is so sick. Jean Ziegler, who is the former UN Special Rapporteur on the Right of Food, said, quote, "Every child who dies from hunger is assassinated." What he meant by that was that every one of those deaths could have been prevented because there's enough food in the world to feed 12 billion people, and yet there are only 7 billion on the planet. So the hunger that we see in Haiti with people eating mud pies and the hunger that we see elsewhere around the world is neither natural nor inevitable. In fact, it is the result of policy choices. And as depressing as that is on one level, that actually gives me great hope, because what it means is that different policies can yield different outcomes.
As long as climate change doesn't wreck it up, right?
As long as climate change doesn't wreck it up, but even with climate change, we have the potential, and young children and pregnant women and others have to die of unnecessary hunger.
The United States, and that's now been a few years ago, said that there is no human right to food, there is only the opportunity to buy food. That was the U.S. position on this. What do you think of that?
Well, it doesn't surprise me, and I laugh because it is just so perverse and so sick. And the U.S. is, I believe, one of the few countries in the world that hasn't passed the U.N. Convention on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. Of course, the right to food is a fundamental human right. It is as fundamental as the right to be free from torture. In fact, it's more fundamental because one thing that unites every one of us on the planet, we all eat. And if anyone is without the right to food, well, we might as well just lay down and die. We've already lost the goal. If we cannot all work to sustain ourselves as one teeny tiny little planet with one large and connected, interconnected human family, what's the point of any of it?
To what extent do people in food movements practice gift economy, especially as it relates to food?
Oh my goodness. Across the world, I think that food has traditionally been viewed as something that belonged to the family, belonged to the community. We certainly see it in the U.S. in different ways because gift economy still exists here. We just don't have the right lenses on to see it. Of course, it's been a lot more beaten down by capitalism. But the story of Thanksgiving today, I mean, obviously traditionally it was about another form of theft of Native people's land and food, but the idea that little children are taught as early as nursery of sharing food, that's key. You know, we still prize feeding people when they show up at our house. But I would say that much more than in this country, with its modernity and idea of scarcity and such, all over the world, food is considered a community good. And there are many cultures where you never go to a political meeting without there being food. You never go to a person's house without immediately being told to please sit down and eat first, and then we will talk later. In Iraq, if someone shows up at your house, you are obligated to feed that person for 3 days. And then, I've been told by Iraqis, then you say, what is your name and why did you come here? In fact, it still exists in a lot of countries in just remarkable ways. Even places that don't have enough food will share, because that's the nature of survival. So gift economies have actually been one of the ways that people have avoided starvation around the world. You don't have money today, so I was growing in my back garden, and so I would just, without even a bag of food for your little ones. And then you will not necessarily return it to me, but pass it on down the line, pass it forward. So gift economies really underscore the same values, actually, that food justice and food sovereignty hold. And it's a beautiful question that you ask, because I think at the center of gift economies, and actually at the center of community sharing, is food.
How powerful is the picture that corporations put out to especially third world places like Haiti? You need investment by foreign corporations, or you'll always be backward, and you need to make the foreign investors feel secure. So you have to basically, I think the saying, give up your way of life. You have to turn everything over to what the investors want. How powerful an argument are they making there?
Well, I don't actually really think it's about the persuasive power of their argument. I think it is about the hard power, pressure of the United States government, other Western governments, the World Trade Organization, the World Bank, and the International Monetary Fund, all of which have ways to force low-income countries to accept a lot of this, even though the countries may know that it is in opposition, have felt a lot of pressure to give in to this corporate trade.
Which then brings me to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And I know that even with it not yet in effect, that the nation of Peru has been under tremendous pressure, as you put it, to pay a huge amount, billions of dollars, to a corporation, because Peru said, you're polluting this region with your oil, and the people are getting sick, and the mining, and the people are getting sick, and we want you to stop. And they sued Peru for loss of profit. This NAFTA on steroids TPP would really see that ramped up. So how will that affect food sovereignty if it's passed?
Well, it will be extremely detrimental, just as you say, Kelia. It's yet another example of a trade pact that has been negotiated with very unequal terms. So the low-income countries have not had the power to stand up against the U.S. and others who are pushing it. We don't always read about this in the paper, but there are often a lot of threats.
That's our program for today, July 11th. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our email news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us next Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Alex Sarah Davis.
And I'm Marco. Today's news was produced by Christine Kim. From the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening. Now stay tuned for... Neil's Hidden Tracks at 6 p.m.
It's the Stranded right here.
Oh, sorry. I'm not so. Now stay tuned for Stranded right here on CITR 101.9 FM.